that I'm a dreamer, for the things I feel and see, or that nothing can be accomplished from the things I wish to be. Tell me not that I'm fanatic, for the things I feel inside, they are flowers of oppression, born of pain I cannot hide. Do not look upon my actions as the acts of one insane, when I take up modern weapons to avenge my father's name. Let your eyes scan all the ghettos through the books of history. Then you'll understand this feeling and just how it came to be. Sure, I must admit I'm bitter for the precious blood I've bled, and for the years of cruel oppression that you've heaped upon my head, for the rape of my grandmothers and the mulattoes that you have left, for the many, 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 many years of slavery with his legacy of death. Tell me not that I'm a dreamer. Oh no, it's you that cannot see. I'm just another victim of a cruel reality. What manner of man is this, I ask, who roams the seven seas, who graced the skies and birds of On and wanders where he pleases, who walks into another's home and takes his property, then slays the man, his wife and child, in the name of liberty? What manner of beast is this, I ask, who drops the napalm from the skies, then send my sons away to war to maim and kill and die? What manner of man is this, I ask, who arrogantly displays his might? What manner of man is this, my friend? Needless to say, he's white. So take your hands off of me, white folks. I've done you no wrong. I'm only guilty of making you strong. I've built all of your cities, and I've worked in your mines. I've fought to protect you many a time. It was I who taught you what it is to be brave. I had great civilizations when you lived in caves. I taught you what soap was when you dyed yourselves blue. I taught you planting and harvesting too. I showed you what clothes were to cover your backs when you were in wolf skins and running in packs. When you knew nothing of the barrier of sound, it was I who taught you that this planet was round. In Palermo, Sicily, and Italy, and Spain, I left monuments of my grandeur and fame. And during your dark ages, when your people were blind, I built universities to enlighten your kind. When your homeland was weak and your people were poor, it was I who brought you to America's shore. While you did not even know how to survive, I showed you medicine to keep you alive. How earnest you seemed, how well you did learn, how vile the reward I received in return. But time is on my side. I'm sure you must know that the day will arrive when you'll reap what you sow. For I gave you religion, and you know it's a fact that the Christ and the Buddha and Muhammad were black. I taught you to dance, and I taught you to sing. You repaid me with treachery, with slavery and chains. So don't touch me, whitey, and don't look surprised. No, I'm no longer fooled by your tricks and your lies. I'm aware of your game and of your history, and I'm aware of the Judas that you have been to me. So watch out for me, white folks. It's a matter of time. I'll soon be together. Then vengeance is mine.
For African people, nothing important happens without a libation. And so for this very important presentation, we begin by the pouring of libation. We pour libation first to our first ancestor, to that hidden one who, though hidden, manifests in all things as all things, that God-goddess idea in the universe by any and all names. To our first ancestor, we pour libation, Ashe. We pour libation too to our ancestors because they were the first people on this planet, mothers and fathers of all mankind, flashpoint of the human family. To those ancestors we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to our ancestors because they were the ones who first gave birth to the idea of civilization, knew we would need a form of governance, and they nurtured that idea along the Nile until it reached its zenith in Kemet. There they built these gigantic monuments as evidence of that great civilization. And they carved instructions on the walls of temples and tombs for us, so we would never forget. To those ancestors, we pour libation, ashe. Pour libation too to our ancestors, because over time they put together all the tenets of civilization and they took those ideas and left the continent. They were the people of the first Exodus. They left Africa and went all over the world and peopled the world. To those ancestors, we pour libation, ashe. We pour libation too to our ancestors because they did not sit on their laurels. They continued to improve, continued to evolve. And at each point of evolution, they again would leave the continent. Leave the continent and settle and resettle the planet. They met themselves coming and going. To those ancestors, we pour libation, ashe. Pour libation too to those ancestors because over time, they found themselves the object of a forced exodus. When they were kidnapped, shackled, cargoed, shipped out of Africa and enslaved in diasporas around the world. To those ancestors, we pour libation, ashe. Pour libation too to the ancestors left at home, the very young, the aged, the infirm, left to reinvent themselves, depleted of us, human resources. But they were enjoined by us in the diasporas, both objects of a global myopia that ruptured the soul of a people as it ravaged a continent. To those ancestors, we pour libation, ashe. Pour libation too to those ancestors because over time they began to remember who and what they were. Because no matter where they had been dropped off, they still retained bits and pieces of who and what they were. They retained that African core that described them. They began to remember bits and pieces of a song. They began to remember lines from a rhythm. They began to remember dances that they did in ancient times. They began to remember those ancient drum beats that they now beat out on bare skin. And so to those ancestors, we pour libation, ashe. Pour libation too to them because they then began to teach each other. They began to resurrect and reconstruct that history and that culture. They became the new Africans wherever they were. They became the new teachers, preachers, archaeologists, the new singers, dancers, the new drummers, the new Jalia. They reconstructed that history and our culture and became new Africans everywhere. So to those ancestors, we pour libation, ashe. Pour libation to those ancestors because they are the ones who passed that information on to us. And so we pour libation to those of you who will watch this presentation. Those of you who are the recipients of that pieced together history, of that reconstructed culture. To you, we pour libation, ashe. Pour libation too to our children and those yet to be born. For they are the ones that you must teach. And you can only teach if you know the history. So to you who are learning the history and are passing on that history, and to our children who are learning that history and will pass that history on to all eternity. For they will call your name in all eternity. To our children we pour libation. Ashe. Ashe. Ashe.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
Yeah. You're listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Hotep and greetings, my sisters and brothers. Welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank. I am your host, William Rogers. So glad to have you here with us on another Tuesday evening as we celebrate the culture and the history and the empowerment of our people. So we're here today with a very interesting subject, and we're going to be talking with a lot of you about this dynamic thing topic that we should never, ever forget. It's kind of snowing here in Wisconsin, not real heavy, little light snow, but it is cold. But this is Wisconsin, that's what you can expect. So I hope wherever you are, what part of the country you're in, your day has been pleasant and has been very, very productive. So again, we operate on the timeforanawakening.com network, which is a part of the Black Talk Radio network system. We're so happy to be here. We're in such good company, wonderful family, and it is a very powerful family relationship with all of us and all of the programs that exist on this network. And a lot of you help make it that as well. I just don't want to take that for granted. I want to let you know that always. We appreciate you. We really, really, really do. We are a call-in format, and you can call in and talk with us or ask questions. Or if you are on the internet, you can just call us at 215-490-9832. And I repeat, 215-490-9832. And you can ask questions, join in on the conversation. And we just have a good old time dealing with the history and culture of our people. I love my people, and I love talking to them. I love talking with them. I love talking and looking at what they have done. Every time I think about it, it just empowers me, you know, all of the wonderful things our folk have been and have done, and how that history was kept from us. It was blocked so that we did not know and could not be empowered for that. And that's what we've got to do, is pass that on to our children so they can become empowered. And I have seen them, when they learn their history and know about who they are and where they've come from and what some of our folk were doing, you see a new attitude in their face. And we got to keep promoting and pushing that. And that's why we are here on Tuesday evenings to do that. We are a think tank format. We come together to think about and talk about solutions, looking at ways that we can further empower our community. We are in some very challenging times right now, as all of you know. COVID-19. We're finally getting rid of insanity out of the governing body of this country. Maybe now we'll have some sense of peace, hopefully. And I do look optimistically upon that relationship. But very clearly, we need somewhere that we can sit and talk to each other from time to time. So those of you who are listening, pass it on to your friends. Tell them to give us a call. Listen, we're not trying to tell you what to do, or we don't know everything, and we're looking to learn from you. I learn every day when I talk on this program format, and I continue to do that. As an old saying I learned from one of my mentors years ago, he said, learning is from the cradle to the grave, and that is true. And so I'm always learning. As you know, we always like to give honor to our ancestors, as I've said just a few minutes ago. but we do that in a special way. We do what we call ancestral profile, and as I've indicated, we try to make it a commentary as well. We're not so much looking at just doing a history. We want to kind of talk about some things. And tonight we're going to talk about a little bit about historiography and looking at how we have to write our history. I'm afraid that some of the generation that are coming behind us are not going to know how they need to research and teach history to our people, and that's because of electronic media, social media. Everybody learns from YouTube, Wikipedia, and all of that. And I'm not saying anything is wrong with that. I'm not knocking that at all, but that's not the scholarship of a John Henry Clark. That's not the scholarship of a Dr. E.E. Thorpe. That's not the scholarship of John Hope Franklin. That's not the scholarship of Charles Wesley. These are people that went down into the archives of libraries, down into dusty basements, and looked at original records and notes and ideas. And so we need to talk about that and how we can begin to add to. I'm not saying take away Facebook, not take away YouTube, don't take away Wikipedia, but we can add to the empowerment of these ideas, and so that history that's critical for us can be told in a truthful manner. And that's one of the biggest things. Our history was omitted. There were two sins that were said. There was the sin of commission and sin of omission. They omitted a lot of our history, and then they wrote junk that wasn't true into our history. And so those of us who are out here still on the battlefield, like myself, my good friend Dr. Bruce Bridges, brothers like Brother Muhammad, who's writing this whole piece on reparations, and so many others are doing the work to make sure that stays. So tonight I want to talk about a sister who was in that category, who was recognized what I'm just saying now and realized that it needed to have been done a little bit more effectively. Her name is Drusilla Dungy Houston. Drusilla Dungy Houston. Sister Houston was born in 1876, and she transitioned in 1941. She was a self-trained historian and a journalist. Drusilla Dungy Houston was born in Harpers Ferry, Virginia in 1876. Her parents were Reverend John Williams and Lydia Taylor Dungy. Drusilla's younger brother, Roscoe, was a journalist and civil rights activist in Oklahoma City. In 1915, he founded the black newspaper, the Black Dispatch, and immediately Drusilla became a contributing editor and dedicated columns to the racial uplift of African Americans. Houston became the quintessential race woman during the time she lived. She was influenced by the great W.E.B. Du Bois in a book that he wrote in 1915 called The Negro. And in that, he discredited white racist scholarship that Africans had no history. Houston, without the help of research assistants, philanthropic funding, Twitter, Facebook, and all of those other instruments, or access to many research repositories, set out anyway to write a three-volume study on the influence of ancient Kushites in the Nile Valley, India, Europe, and America. In fact, after the publishing of her now classic, Wonderful Ethiopians of the Ancient Kushite Empire, 1926, she wrote W.E.B. Du Bois a letter in 1926 thanking him for inspiring her and informed him that she was not trying to reach the white race. Her book was dedicated to people of African descent, and she wanted to debunk the racist notion of the Klan and all race haters. Although the book is maybe considered by some to be outdated today, Houston's landmark scholarship in 1926 helped establish the undeniable fact that black Africans influenced civilizations in the ancient world. Drusilla Dungy Houston. Now, these are the kind of folks we want to talk about. This is the purpose of our program tonight, is to look at that scholarship of this nature and also carefully encourage a continuation of that type of learning and type of thinking. So tonight I thought maybe we would talk a little bit about black nationalism, which is something we're always talking about. It's never minus that. As long as a nation of Islam, as long as there's a Malcolm X, even a Martin Luther King, and some of our other great brothers and sisters' memories are still around, we will always be talking black nationalism. First of all, black nationalism goes way back. It starts as a concept with the great Martin Delaney, but its work goes all the way back to the African ships of capture that landed on these shores, where our brothers and sisters knew that they were not supposed to be there, knew that this was an act of war, and were attempting to find ways to free themselves from that. It goes back that far. But as a discipline and as a study and as a precise concept, you have to go back and you can look at people like Martin Delaney, Alexander Cromwell, and some of the others who actually sat down and put the concept of black nationalism to pen. And so because of that, we are able to go back and get a feeling of the fight that our ancestors. One of the things that we want to clearly make sure, and I encourage any of you that teach our children or have children, there is no such truth to the fact that we didn't fight back. We fought back every single step of the way, from the shores of Africa, West Africa, all the way to the shores of America. We fought, fought, fought. And not only did we just fight, not only did we just fight wildly, we fought calculatedly. There were calculations of war development. We put to pen a lot of the ideas and methods. And so that's one of the energies tonight for me to talk a little bit about that. And I've asked a lot of our panelists to join us tonight and talk a little bit about it. So the ideology of black nationalism, though, all the way from the classical period, goes way back. There's a brilliant scholar by the name of Wilson Jeremiah Moses, and I'm sure that many of you have heard him. He's written many works on early black nationalism. And so tonight, much of our discussion is going to come from his research. We kind of talk a little bit about that and what he did. The ideology, he said, of black nationalism has gone through several phases of rise and decline. It goes from its what's called its proto-nationalistic phase, which was in the late 1700s. Yes, as we said, 1700s, black nationalism was at work, to its hiatus in the 1830s. It went from flourishing in the 1850s in the eclipse of the 1870s. And then at apex, it comes to a pinnacle. Those of you who are online now, could you please mute your phone? Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
That's why I call you.
Could you please mute your phone? Dr. Bridges, could you mute your phone? Dr. Bridges, can you mute your phone? Okay. Sorry about that. the whole idea of the black nationalist concept has very early beginnings, right on into the years of Garvey, going on into the years of even the Civil Rights Movement with Black Panthers, the New Africa Movement, and some of those ideas. So black nationalists have sometimes proposed to sort of fuse the entire continent of Africa into what's known as a super state. But that's not black nationalism, in which all black persons might claim citizenship. Classical black nationalism in the United States is defined as the ideology that argued for the self-determination, kuchichagalia, of African Americans within the framework of an independent nation state. And this came into existence at the end of the 18th century. It was therefore one of the earliest expressions of nationalism, period. And while it originated in unison along some of the case stuff with the American Revolution and the French Revolution, it was not an imitation of those. They were not attempting to imitate the French Revolution. The Haitian revolt was not a copy of the French Revolution, and that needs to be clear. So the proto-nationalistic drive towards self-determination in the Americas is really identifiable in the creation of places like the Brazilian Republic of Palmares in the 1600s. It can also be seen among the enslaved Africans who managed to gain their freedom by taking refuge in maroon societies, isolated strongholds of resistance in the wilderness areas, most notably in Jamaica and Suriname. I was on a panel discussion yesterday talking about Martin Luther King on a Zoom, and a young woman asked me a question, and she said, what does a free, self-determining state look like? What would that look like for African people? And that was my answer. My answer would be one of those maroon colonies somewhere back up in the mountains of Jamaica, or somewhere out in Suriname, or in some isolated place where you have complete control of the space and the timing of your life. And she said, and she thought about it. I said, that's complete independence. That's complete self-determination. So, and that is what occurred back in the 16th. The maroon communities are known to have existed in North America, and references are frequently made to instances in Florida where Africans who were on the run linked up with the Seminoles and creators. I talked about last week. There was that area up in by St. Augustine, Florida. That was Fort Mose. Fort Mose was a place where Africans could independently and self-determinedly live and operate. So tonight I thought maybe I wanted to talk a little bit about this whole idea of black nationalism and looking at it in those very early years, and look at some of those sheroes and heroes that were involved. I've got somebody that very clearly I worship. And I must admit, I didn't come into him and into his greatness until late. I mean, I knew of him because of my parents and what they were involved in. But I really didn't know his real work and what he really was accounted for. And that was the American Toussaint Louverture in a certain way. His name was Prince Hall. Prince Hall, powerful brother. And so tonight we have a brother supposedly that's supposed to come on. I hope he will be able to come on. He's writing a book currently on Prince Hall. We all know Prince Hall from the Masonic relationship that he had. But very clearly there's much, 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 much more to him than just the Masonic. And not to take anything away from the Masonic, I'm okay with that. But he definitely was a lot more powerful. One of the things that Dr. Wilson Moses does that I like in his book, and what some of the other scholars have done, like Kehinde X, they've gone back and looked at the material from Europe and white America that was used to diminish African life and culture, and what this material did and the damage it did, which is why we have to correct this. You can't let this just sit and think it is going to evolve into what's being right. We've got to change that. And that's one of the things that he does. And one of the people, and I've talked about that this on this program, one of the people that we've got to go back in and really deconstruct is the child molester by the name of Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson was a danger. And Dr. Moses recently did some work, did a book around 2019 on Thomas Jefferson, his attempt to deconstruct him. But Jefferson was dangerous in terms of what he did in the image of African people. One of the things that he did is he had a notebook he used to carry around with him as he walked through the plantations, and I guess even as he slept with Sally Hemings and produced all those kids, he probably would finish with her, get up, sit on the side of the bed, and take notes and write about what he just did. I guess I'm just saying that, kind of making point. but he probably did do something of that caliber. Well, Jefferson walked around with this book all the time. He took notes down, handwritten, And the name of the book was Notes on Virginia, on the state of Virginia. And over the years, that book has been edited, and they've gone in and taken stuff out that that was really, really damaging in a lot of ways in looking at how people would perceive African people. And one of the things that was in that book is Jefferson was attempting to try to describe what he felt was the color of the skin of African people and where that came from. And he said that he felt that it was probably a malfunction of the bile duct, and that what had happened is that the bile duct had eroded or disrupted or something, and the feces had gotten under the skin of the African, creating that color and as well as that smell. And he wrote that in his book. And he also wrote about the feverish nature of them. He wrote notes on the children, and he talked about that and how they act and how they act as compared to the way the adults act. And he used that as a part of his captivity program and activity. Thing that we saw later on how to break a slave and how to crack them. Well, that's what they did. They studied them first. And this, obviously, this studying is so far unscientific as you can find. And it's the same kind of thing that continued on even into the 20th century when we saw works like the Bell Curve and some other things that came along. But that was one of the reasons why black nationalism had to come to place. There had to become a group of writers and scholars who would correct this ugly, ugly history. And so my sister that we talked about earlier, who very clearly wanted to do something, and there were others, not only just her, Du Bois, the great Du Bois was also very concerned. And then the hero of us all, Carter Woodson, even really became very sophisticated about it. And even though Sister Houston was self-trained, Carter Woodson would bring some of that university training and develop a historical system to learn how to study the African properly. And so in a couple of weeks, we are going to be celebrating his work and the things that he did. And not only did he just talk about researching and study, he created a journal. He created a magazine. He created a study group. He created a celebration period. And he did all of those things in order to make sure that we studied the history. And there's a lot of work been done on those kind of folk who were doing that. One of the key individuals that I love dearly, and he was a mentor, a personal mentor during my undergraduate years. His name is Dr. Earl E. Thorpe. He did an examination of African historians of the 19th through the mid-20th centuries, and he talked about their problem with respect to African history as one of the neglect of the study of African people in the United States. He argued that because the Euro-American elitism that ignored those members of the human family who did not belong to the European groups, was not either written about or either negatively written about. The situation has since that time been expanded to a recognition of the paucity of critical examination of some of the major figures in African history whose influence that we know and whose influence that we fail, who are African cultural specialists, political, intellectual movements in the United States and in the rest of the world as they studied the history of our people. There have, of course, been efforts in this regard. Dr. Thorpe's book was called Negro Historians in the United States, published in 1958. He wrote another book called The Central Theme of Black History, 1969. And I'm going to bring on a brother in a few minutes who knows all about that. He was right there during those years with me. working under this powerhouse of a historian. He wrote another book called Black Historians, A Critique, in 1969, and he examined the work of both professional academic as well as the non-professional African historian in two centuries. And what makes it, unfortunately, what makes the difference between a professional academic and a non-professional academic is you have to go through those halls and study and get your PhD under these university systems, which is not always the best way to learn the history. But nevertheless, the profession has said that that's the way it's considered. And if you don't go through that training source, a lot of the things you attempt to try to do in the historical profession is overlooked. And so that's why we had to create, and that's why Carter Woodson created our own system. So you've got historians like the sister Darlene Clark Hines. She wrote something called The State of Afro-American History, Past, Present, and Future. She did that in 1986. Two white guys by the name of August Meyer and Elliot Rudrick wrote a book called Black History and the Historical Profession, 1980, which included a major examination of the work of Carter G. Woodson. So they critiqued Woodson as well. And a lot of that history was written in the past by whites. And so it was the African historians that would come, people like Benjamin Quarles, who wrote a book called The Black Mosaic, Essays in Afro-American History and Historiography. He did that, published 1988. Another important work is a book called The Writing of History, Riddling the Sphinx, that was written as well. All of these are about the historian and the historian profession. And that has to be paid attention. I know YouTube's got some great stuff on there. And I know you can go on there and listen to a lot of history about things that are happening. But that's the dispensing of just the information. History has to be critiqued. You have to understand what the African was going through on a Jefferson plantation and what that meant. Carter Woodson, and when he published the Journal of Negro History, the first edition, edition number one, volume number one, he wrote about the problem of the mulatto and the things that they would go through. That's the kind of deciphering of the history to help, because that is going to create a confusion in African-American culture. And so things of that nature. So again, I'm not knocking you two, but that, it has to go deeper than that. And then another one of my heroes, a great historian by the name of Charles Wesley. He wrote a piece called The Intellectual Tradition of a Black Historian. Carter Woodson, A Historical Reader, was another piece. And I could go on and on. And then you had those that were not quite as famous, had not done all of that PhD book writing stuff, but they were still great historians. People like William Leo Hansberry, J.A. Rogers, Dr. Ben, John Jackson, Chancellor Williams, Drusilla Dungy Houston, J.C. DeGraff Johnson, George G.M. James, and of course, my hero, Dr. John Henry Clark. And so this is the kind of shadows that we are operating in now. We are operating in the shadows of this great mind. And these are brothers and sisters who went at it day after day after day and provided that direction to our children so that you could pull together an ASCAP. There would not have been an ASCAP if there would not have been these great minds. And so the thing that I'm talking about tonight is, how do we continue this? How do we making sure that this black nationalist tradition continues? I like the work that Dr. Karenga did when he did Kwanzaa and created the Nguzo Saba. I like that. I can't take that away from Dr. Karenga. It was a brilliant. He took the Malefi Asante's Afrocentricity idea, turned it into the Kawaida idea in a certain way, and created his own basis for studying and looking at that. Because at that time, you had scholars working around them, people like Diane Ravitch and Schlesinger and some of those others that were writing all that negative stuff. And they were able to clearly, through documentation and in-depth study, get into the whole ideas of that. And then I'm gonna stop a minute and open up the line, introduce some folks I asked to join us. There's one other thing you got to also understand about this historical research. The real information, the information that tells us the truth about things. And let me say something. All of black history is not going to be, all of it is not going to be good. That's some ugly stuff. Nobody is perfect. There are no perfect people. There are going to be people and there are going to be stories in our history that are not pleasant, that are not always the way we want them to be. At one time, they wrote history what was called the great man theory. You just always how great they were and how well they did this. And so we learned about Frederick Douglass and Paul Ernst Dunbar, Harriet Tubman, and they were good. I'm not taking anything away from them. But there were some other black folk that were doing some powerful stuff. And then there were some black folk doing some ugly stuff. We need to talk about them, too, because you got some of those today. You got some black folk out here doing some ugly stuff. And we need to tell that history so we know how to move forward as a people. But the real history are in those archives and in those databases that are very, very difficult to get to. So if you are not coming out of a university system where you can get a pass to go into the think tanks and read some of that material and some of those archives, you will not be able to get to the letters of Zora Neale Hurston. You will not be able to reach the letters of John Henry Clark and how they have been cataloged. You won't be able to get that. You're going to have to pray somebody goes in there who can get it and does some writing, or else it will go unknown. You will not be able to get in and read the letters of Malcolm X and the Honorable Elijah Muhammad without the research pass to do that. And those are in those university databases. University databases who have been funded by white philanthropic racist money. The University of North Carolina has one of the largest databases on slavery in the world. But the University of North Carolina is funded by former slave owners. The very largest of that information is the University of Texas at Austin. The University of Texas at Austin has a humongous database on slave material. And things like, and when we talk about slave material, we talk about the records of plantation owners.
Gentlemen, I just called in and I joined the call, and I just wanted to make it known that I was here and that I was listening also. My name is Solomon Burnett.
Okay, thank you, sir. We'll be finished in just a minute. At this point, this information is very, very important to be able to go find that. But unless you are, like I said, connected to some university or pay some astronomical fee, like $300 or $400 a month, you will not be able to have access to that. So that's why it's critical that we have individuals within our grasp that are qualified to be able to go in there. They're not letting everybody go in there. I remember I was doing some research on J.A. Rogers' book, The Five Negro Presidents. And I had gone to the New York Public Library rare book section to find some papers on Warren Hardin. Those of you who read that book, you know, Warren Hardin was listed as one of the five Negro presidents. He was the 29th president of the United States. And all of the material that documented the fact of who he was and his ethnicity had been either burned, thrown away, or was in rare books and rare book sessions, and you can't get into those without having data. So I went there about 10 o'clock in the morning, and at the time I was in school, and I went there about 10 o'clock in the morning and told them I wanted to get a copy of the book, The 29th President of the United States, Warren G. Hardin. And he said, well, I need to have your university ID. I need to have a letter from the department of the chair of your department agreeing to that. I said, well, no, I don't have that. I mean, I don't have. He said, well, then I'm not going to be able to let you in. So I went on to try to explain, and I sat there with him, and we went back and forth with each other for about 15 minutes. He said, all right, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to have you do a guest. I'm going to do a special thing. I'm going to have you fill out this form. I'm going to have to make some calls, and then you'll have to come back in about 2 or 3 hours and determine what's going on, if I'll be able to let you in. So I filled out this 2-page application, and I then gave it to him. And I didn't go anywhere because I didn't, you know, it's New York City, right downtown, 40 downtown area, and I'm not going to go anywhere. So I just said I might as well stay here and look through some books. By that time, it was 11:30. At about 10 minutes to 5, this man came over to me and said, sir, let me speak with you. He said, okay. He said, I can grant you a 20-minute permission to go in and look at the book that you've requested. He said, you cannot take paper. You cannot take pencils. You cannot take any kind of crayon, any kind of pen. You'll have to leave everything at the desk, and you can take it. I'll give you the book, and you have 20 minutes to look at it. I couldn't believe it. So I said, well, what would it take to do? He said, I would have to have a letter from the chair of your department saying that you are doing research on a specific area. I need to know the name of that research and where it's going. Now, I think a lot of that's changed a little bit now. It's not quite that bad, but this was bad back then. That's what it takes to get into those libraries, to get some of that information and some of those letters and archives that are extremely important to writing our history. So that's why we are doing this program tonight. We want to talk about setting up things that we can begin to help folk. I know you got the internet now. You got Wikipedia. But watch out. That's not scholarship all the time. Some of it's good. Some of it's not. And you got some of these other databanks. One of the best databanks that I've often used is Gestor. But again, Gestor is expensive. If you're just doing fun research, if you're doing paid research, and you got a fellowship where they paid you to do it, and you can got the money that you can go into those archives, that's a different story. So anyway, with that, that's what we want to talk about. I have asked, as always, my good friend Dr. Bridges, Bruce Bridges, to join me. He is a historian, geographer. He understands what I'm saying, and just to kind of pass on along. Dr. Bridges is kind of like almost getting close to the top of the hour. I wanted to do that commentary just so that everybody would know where we're going. As I said, in a couple weeks, we'll be celebrating all of this throughout our communities, and we need to make sure that our people and our young people are preparing themselves to know how to study this history. So kind of, if you would, open up by giving us just a little bit of your experience. Don't have long. I think your guest that you asked to come on is on. So you might want to talk to him a little bit about this black nationalist concept that we said. But anyway, how are you doing this afternoon, my brother?
I'm doing a lot better than I was when you called me earlier, Dr. Rogers. And I'm doing a whole lot better now that I've tuned into your program. I think that's very healthy for me to tune in, because you're calling the roll with all the historians, J.C. DeGraff Johnson and J.A. Rogers and George G.M. James. You really did a good job calling the roll.
Thank you.
And another good point that you made, because you talked about so many things I could talk about just before we get to the hour, and I did call several people, and I want to give them a chance to make some comments. But I wanted to mention the fact that much of the history, as you said, we have to go beyond, YouTube. That's out. But we also have to go beyond the traditional academic circles to get the true history of our people.
Right.
For example, and just to give you some history, J. Rogers, a lot of the things that J. Rogers talked about, he actually traveled around the world and saw some of those things and wrote them down. And as you well know, when we talk about historians, J. Rogers, a lot of so-called, quote-unquote, academic historians do not respect the work of J. Rogers for that reason, because he didn't follow the traditional method, But who says we have to follow traditional methods? except for the same man who has enslaved us and who set up the traditional methods. You know, so sure. we can deviate from what he has taught us. And Jay Rogers actually went and saw metal in the pyramid of Cheops, and he traveled to the Isles, he traveled to China. He actually went around and saw some of the things that he wrote about. He did much more traveling than we have, and so why wouldn't he be qualified to talk about some of the things that he saw? So I wanted to mention that. And I also wanted to mention that I have found that you actually learn more from the ones who have not gone to the traditional colleges, universities, and institutions of higher learning to study our history. You find more out from people who have not done that. And I mentioned that when I mentioned Jay Rogers. You mentioned it, too, when you said John G. Jackson and several other ones that we could talk about that did go the traditional route, but they had Drusilla Dungy Houston. Of course, she was another one. She didn't go the traditional route, but she did a tremendous amount of research, you see. And so I think we have to respect those who have come before us and who have, you know, shown us the way when it comes to African historians and contributions that we have made as a people. And Carter G. Woodson was a little different because he went through the tremendous right. academic circles by being the second African American to receive a doctorate when he went to the University of Chicago and in history. And he went to the Philippines and became a principal. But he went through the traditional routes, but his research was not following the same path or the same pattern or the same analysis as some of the so-called historians. Right. He did it his way.
Dr. Bridges?
Yeah, I'm still here. Okay, okay. So somebody was getting out of the car.
Yeah,
again.
Somebody was getting out of the car. I hated to do that. Okay.
Yeah, but I just happened to wanted to mention that since you mentioned Carl G. Woodson. And another thing about Dr. Woodson is when you read his history, he started off in the coal mines of West Virginia. And also Carter G. Woodson used to read newspapers that he had gathered to read to the coal miners in West Virginia. He worked in a little cafe that they had in West Virginia, and when they would take lunch breaks or come in for breakfast, he would read newspapers, black newspapers that he had gotten for them from around, you know, various places in the world. So he's a person that we should study. He didn't go the complete traditional route. He went the traditional
right.
route,
right.
partially, but not totally. And another thing that I'm going to be quiet, but there are people, too, like Gerald Massey, would not be a traditional type person. Godfrey Higgins, who wrote The Anacalypsis, would not be a traditional
right,
type
right.
historian. And also the brother that wrote the Black Man in Africa 100,000 years ago, his name escapes me right now. He was half white, but I learned this from Dr. Richard King. You see, that's another thing
right,
that we can do.
Right.
Travel and get close to some of our people. For example, I traveled out to California with one of your guests. I think you say he's on the phone, and we definitely want to get to him. Dr. Fahim Knight, we traveled to California. We met Richard King. We met Dr. Ligon on the West Coast. We went to another one, Manly P. Hall, who headed up Philosophical. Right, you forgot. You see, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Manly P. Hall, who wrote The Secret Teachers of All Ages, and who headed up the Philosophical Research Library. We went out there. I went to Chicago and visited John G. Jackson and sat in his house in the projects. In the projects. I want to make clear to our listeners who John G. Jackson. I didn't say up in Bel Air in California, or I didn't say up in Mount Vernon, New York, or I didn't say Old Farms and Traburn in North Carolina, but John G. Jackson was in the projects of Chicago, and I sat with him and talked to him for hours. And anyway, we could go on with that, but that's another good topic.
Right. I like that,
yes,
Dr. Bridges. Thank you so much. And you're right. I mean, that's why we want to talk about this tonight. Because we have to create a vehicle, a venue or something where our young people can teach it. Everything doesn't have to be taught in the the halls of Harvard and Duke and Yale. I mean, they're good. I love Morehouse. I love Spelman. I love North Carolina Central. I love it. But
you love Howard. You love Howard, even though they fired the father of Black history, though, didn't they?
Right, exactly. Right, but still, you know, we can do this in another way. All right, we want to get to some of your guests, Dr. Bridges. I'm gonna take a break. It's at the top of the hour. I'm gonna take a quick break, and then we're gonna come back and talk to the brother. Is the brother that is doing the work on Prince Hall? Is he on? Is he gonna still be able to come? You think?
Oh, I don't know. I thought you had seen his number. That 602. He might not be able to make it.
I don't see 602 yet, unless he's. Unless he's calling on a number that's not popping up. There's a couple of unknown callers and wireless callers.
But yeah, anyway. I had a 919-520. I had a 919-451. That's the brother that spoke to you a couple of minutes ago. So, yeah, let's take a break then.
We'll come back to side with the brother at 451, 919-451. All right, let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
Yes, sir. Thank y'all.
Now, if you understood this, maybe we could free ourselves. We are totally an unobligated people. We don't owe anybody anything anywhere, left or right. Everybody that has come among us have come among us to exploit us, and they have exploited us successfully. Now, let us begin at the beginning, because African people stood alone at the beginning of the world and started humanity and started a thing as basic as tool making, as basic as making a bucket, a basket, as basic as learning how to use fire, how to bring down animals. Started all of this in the area to the south. When we look at and visualize a map of Africa, you have to visualize the Nile River and realize that that river is like the womb of a woman. And out of this womb came a series of children. Let us not call it civilization. White people have so misused the word civilization until the word has lost its meaning. Let us call it a culture. Came a series of cultures that developed and moved down that river, a great cultural highway, to establish a way of life and to create a way of life, religions, and history that is going to be so rich that mankind will steal from them from then on. And the rape of the culture of that river would change the world for all time.
Black power means black dignity. Just as surely as you are proud to be white, we're proud to be black. Black is beautiful, baby. It's pretty. I always say to my brothers, I say, baby, don't worry about the white chicks. We got everything from chalk to charcoal in our own race. You know, see? Black is beautiful. Black is beautiful. Black power means dignity. It means we're going to walk side by side with you or through you. We're going to be with dignity and integrity. We don't want any more than you have, and we're not going to accept any less than you have. That's Black power.
It's a long old road
time for an Awakening Media lineup. Monday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., African Perspectives, with host Brother Oshi, Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Same time, same place. Continued Monday lineup, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., Acres of Diamonds, with host Brother Jihad Ahmed, 8 p.m. to 9 p.m., Black Therapy Central, host Dr. Mawia Kambom and Sister Nataki Kambom, 9 p.m. till 10 p.m., Conversation Reparations, first and third Mondays. On Tuesday, 8 p.m. till 10 p.m., Black Reality Think Tank, with host Dr. William Rogers. On Thursday, 7 p.m. till 9 p.m., Melanin Live, with host Lance Jones, co-host Boniswa Ayan. Fridays, 8 p.m. till 10 p.m., Time for an Awakening, with creator of Time for an Awakening and host, Brother Elliot, co-hosted by Brother Richard. Saturday, 4 p.m. till 6 p.m., Black Sister Talk, with host Wanda Chambers. 7 p.m. till 9 p.m., The Elders of Sankofa. And Sunday, 7 p.m. to 9 p.m., Time for an Awakening, host Brother Elliot and co-host Brother Richard. Check us out.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Okay, we are back, my sisters and brothers. Thank you so much for joining us here this evening. Wonderful conversation. We got more for you on the way. I wanted to mention one thing, though. All of our programs are exciting. We try to really present you with information and ideas. This is a think tank format for us here, the Black Reality Think Tank. We have three other programs that operate on the Black Reality Think Tank format. We have the program that operates on Thursday called Melanin Live with Brother Lance Jones. We have a Saturday afternoon program called Black Sister Talk, as the announcement said, and we also have one on Saturday evening at 7 o'clock Eastern, 6 o'clock Central, called The Elders of Sankofa. And that program is hosted by a wonderful young lady, Dr. Janine James. She is an MD. She is sort of semi-retired, and she's been providing us with wonderful information on medical experience, our health, and our well-being, which is a part of any think tank. If we're going to deal with a think tank, you have to have health issues. And co-hosting that with her is Sister Dee Dee Conley, who does a wonderful job, too, of backing and support her, and Brother Horace Crabb, Brother Kwasi. He's one of the co-hosts of that program. And this Saturday, I just want to make note of that, there is a program. It's called Vaccines, Drugs, or Nature. Vaccines, Drugs, or Nature. And Dr. James, as I said, is an MD. All of her friends and colleagues are MDs. So she's raising the question. She says that there is so much to consider when it comes to making a decision to receive a vaccination, start a new medication, or to utilize natural approaches to achieve and maintain health. I thought I would never see a doctor say that, but this doctor does. She believes in that. She says that she is going to bring on the program on Saturday pharmaceutical experts. She's going to bring Dr. Sir Grice, Dr. Alicia Walker, and Dr. Angela Smith, and they will discuss drugs, vaccines, and alternate health. And she will be hosting that, and Sister Dee Dee Conley will be co-hosting that program. And these are pharmaceutical experts who will talk about, is it okay to take the COVID-19 vaccination? These are MDs talking now. So this program airs Saturday at 7 o'clock Eastern, 6 o'clock Central, right here on timeforanawakening.com, or you can call back dialing 215-490-9832 and listen. And also participate in the conversation and ask questions. And so this is the kind of thing that we're trying to do here at the Black Reality Think Tank. We're trying to present a community platform for us to discuss everything that affects our people doing that. So I just wanted to mention that to you so you may get a chance to listen. I think last week they had a high power when they were talking about the murder of our children through poor prenatal care. And she called it a lynching. She said it's like a lynching when young mothers come and don't take it. She had four powerhouse MDs, people who were running OBGYN departments at some of the big major hospitals on the East Coast. And that is available on our archives. All of our programs are archived. All you have to do is go to www.timeforanawakening.com and take a look at those programs, put into the portal Elders of Sankofa, and you can look at some of the programs or either our program, Black Reality Think Tank, Black Sister Talk, or Melanin Live, and you can see some of the past programs that they have had. So with that, okay, Dr. Bridges, we've got the brother here at 477. He is here now, and we want to let me make sure that we didn't lose him.
Hi.
Oh, you're there. Okay, got you. Okay, good. Good afternoon, my brother. How you doing?
I'm doing well. How are y'all?
Okay, great. Is Dr. Bridges on the other end then? Dr. Bridges?
I'm here, yeah.
Okay, gotcha.
That sounds like Brother Solomon, another brother I told about the program. I don't know. It sounds like Brother Solomon.
Yes, sir. That's me. I was just wondering who else are we speaking with? Who else am I in community with at the moment?
He's saying, who else did you recognize, Brother Bruce? Who else did you call?
Yeah, I was just saying, who else is on the line, if I may?
Right now, you have about 25 other people on the telephone.
All right. Excellent. All right. Well, pardon me. We ain't even got to sound off. All love to all of us.
But you also have an internet audience that's listening as well.
Yes, sir.
Right. And this is his first time, too, Dr. Rogers. I just called him and told him to dial the number, so he didn't write. But, Brother Solomon, this is the program coming on. I tell you about it every Tuesday night, the Black Reality Think Tank. And so you heard what we're talking about. So he's wondering if you wanted to make a comment, you know. So if not,
yes,
you can just keep on listening. Mm-hmm.
Oh, no. If I may quickly, this past year and the beginning of this year has taken us all through so many major changes. One thing that quarantine did for me is it actually allowed me to focus my intelligence, on one thing for the first time in a very long time. And I wrote a whole trilogy, but it was so far out of this world that no one would publish it.
Mm.
And then so I went to self-publishing, come to find out it's only one African American owned printing press in the country. It's owned by Damani and Ta-Nehisi's dad.
Oh yeah, Third World Press. I mean,
Black Classic Press.
Black Classic Press. Yeah, okay.
Digital print. And I just want to say that means that none of our intelligence is actually in our hands.
That's right. That's exactly.
And
right.
And one thing the brother said to me was he welcomes all competition because it's something we need to be on. And so within all of our conversations about, it's like you look at the one thing that's different about the academy than us is like if you ever look at them people giving their interviews a lot of times, you know, as opposed to us on the internet, they got like 1,000 books behind them because they going to keep reading books because one thing is they do is they produce books and then they push them to their own students as their own market.
Right, right. Very good.
It's the academy. And so, you know, printing presses are not as expensive as we would think. In actuality, the Black community is in possession of a lot of them, especially churches that print their own pamphlets and things.
Right.
But we should be looking towards really just, in addition to talking about maintaining the historical record and how to do research, really just making sure we got our hands on it, what's ours, in addition to being able to go into the archives. You know, we can make contact with, you know, a professor, and he'll walk you through the door.
Right.
You know what I mean? If he believes in your research, that's a conversation and a handshake.
Right. Yeah, like you said,
as for being able to print our own work without, you know what I mean, a page coming up missing and it being an editorial slip or whatever,
right.
That's or some sinister editorial editing. You know, a footnote out of place, a period moved or something, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah.
And so I would just say within all of our speculation on our research, we need to get into the operation of owning our own printing presses. That's one thing that we lost. And with the movement into digital, you know, I mean, we still black in America. We ain't going to make that leap like everybody else. We still going to value books. And they always going to value a certain type of printing and pamphleteering and proliferation like common sense.
Exactly. Exactly. That's a very good point, my brother. Really good. You're right about that. And that's a critical that we have that. We had black printing presses previously. One right there in Durham, Service Printing Company. Dr. Bridges, you remember, would print. I don't know if they were into book printing, but they were printing other materials that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Nathaniel White down in Haytown, right. Sure yeah. did, right. Yeah. And Brother Solomon, he probably too young to remember the Service Printing Company. It was on Pettigrew Street, and Nat White Jr., Brother Solomon, started that printing press. And his son is the one that tried to restart Haytai several years ago, you know, down on Lakewood Avenue where the Family Dollar is and those kind of programs. But, yeah, but yeah, we did have some printing presses, right, many years, and, of course, Carolina Times. But anyway, yeah, Solomon, too, stay with us, Solomon. We're going to be on until 10 o'clock. I'm glad I called you and told you to tune in.
Right.
I'm here. Thank you.
Thank you so much, my brother. And any point you want to chime in with an idea, be sure. Yeah, we're open to do that. We can kind of open up the mics, kind of let folks do what they want to do. One, you know, you brought up one other good point, my brother, that's real critical that I've been thinking about. A lot of my graduate research work was in the black press and looking at black newspapers, because if you think about it, that was our first intellectual stimulant in the old days, were black newspapers. That's one of the first things that Marcus Garvey did. He started a black newspaper called The Black World. And everybody that has started anything, all the way back from Rushworm on up to the Chicago Defender, Pittsburgh Courier, Amsterdam News, these were the sources of getting information out to our people, even grassroots people. You didn't have to go to the library to get a copy of the Journaling Guide, the Norfolk Journaling Guide, and some of those papers. But now, gone. Every last one of them are just about gone. And I know that there's been a technology shift. I understand that. But still, that's important. The Nation of Islam right now is the only one that's still putting out an independent, developed newspaper. One that they can say what they want to say when they want to say it. And we've got to think about that. We got to take that into consideration. And even back during the days when the presses, the black newspapers were running and moving, there was an issue that a lot of folk didn't quite know. A lot of those papers didn't print their own paper. They had to go to the white newspapers to print it. Because when you print a newspaper, it's done on a machine, at least back then, called a web press. A web press is different than just some of the ones that like make stationery and business cards and all that. That's a different kind of a printer. A newspaper has to have a web press. Everybody didn't have a web press. I did some research here with the newspapers in Wisconsin. Wisconsin had three black newspapers. None of them printed their own paper. They had to go to the white guy to print the paper. And pay him that fee because of the fact that he is the one that had the web press. And so he could jack the prices up, tell you they don't want to print it today, all kind of things. That I don't think that ever happened, but that's the kind of thing we do when we don't understand there's an economic component to our intellectual growth and in the activities that we do. So thank you so much for reminding us that. That's you're right. You're exactly right about that. Brother Herbie, how you doing tonight?
Good evening, Dr. Rogers. I'm doing just fine.
Good.
Enjoying the show as usual.
Great. Thank you, sir. Thank you.
I think Brother Bruce went and some people wouldn't print his book.
Oh, okay. Is that true, Dr. Bridges?
Absolutely true. As a matter of fact, I had contracted with the man to print the book and had taken it to him, my book too, to those who may not know.
Yeah, that's right. It was called
Recapturing African Mind. And once the man, when I went back to pick the copies up and was getting ready to pay him, up was beyond $1,000. And you know, white folk love money. But he told me when I went, and you remember I told you this too, but to those who may not have heard, the white man told me, he said that, I'll never forget those words. I have read your preface and I have read your introduction, and I cannot print your book. So when he said that, I didn't question him. But then he went on to say, but I do know somebody who might print it for you. But he said, I can't print this. So it let me know that I was doing something right. Whenever you say some things and teach some history and give some facts and documentation about African history and their relationship with white people, and if you're telling the truth and if you get obstacles, you know you're doing something right. Now, if you don't get any obstacles, then you may not be doing anything right, because if you really tell it like it's going to be told, it's going to make white people very, very uncomfortable. And the brother who we were talking to earlier, Dr. Rogers' brother Solomon, he has just started, like he said, a publishing company. We can talk to him later about it. He started a publishing company. And he also helped the brother who I told you wrote the book on Prince Hall Masonry, who is not on tonight. He helped him edit and put some of his books out. But another point I wanted to make, too, and I appreciate Herbert for saying that, is that I'm going to tie this into what you said about black nationalism. Whenever you begin to organize, at least back in the day, now we got social media, we got Instagram, we got Facebook, you know, we got Twitter, right. We got talk shows, we got cable television. But back during the day, every organization that was worth its salt had what I call a propaganda machine, which was their newspaper. The Black Panther Party had a newspaper. The NAACP had a newspaper, as we called the Crisis, started by W.B. Du Bois. Marcus Garvey, as you said earlier, had the Negro World. Elijah Muhammad Speaks newspaper that started off as a Final Call. William Lloyd Garrison, the Liberator, Monroe Trotter had his own newspaper. And the list goes on. Any organization that's worth its salt has to have a way to put out or to get out their way of thinking and their thoughts and ideas, because the traditional press is not going to do it. Every black organization, they will always have their own newspapers to publish their side of things.
I agree 100%. I've got it so interesting. We were just talking. I think I have my good friend and my good brother from Atlanta that's on. He's just written a book on reparations. Is that you, Brother Reginald?
Yes, sir, Dr. Rogers. How are you?
Right. Assalamu alaikum, my brother. How you doing?
Good. Good to be on with y'all. Sorry I'm late, but I had another appointment that I had to
Right,
keep
I know tonight. You told me, yeah, you had to go somewhere. Why don't you tell us about, you were on, Brother Reginald Muhammad was on a couple of weeks ago, maybe about 3 weeks ago. He was talking about his new book on reparations. Just published. Right, exactly. Brother Reginald, we kind of talking a little bit about publishing and some of the challenges that we have with when you try to put a piece of work out and what happens. Oh, yeah, I lost you for a minute. I said we are talking about publishing, Brother Reginald, and some of the challenges that African people have when we want to put our intellectual material out into the public. It's just hard to find. I had a brother on that just talked about some work that he had done, and he said the only place he found that was printing books was Tahisi Coates' dad, Black Classic Press, were the only ones that were actually publishing. Tell us a little bit about your experience in the book, and first of all, give us the name of your book and talk a little bit about the experience you had with the printing part of that.
Well, thank you again, Dr. Rogers, for allowing me to be on. One of the things that that we have found, my latest publication is called The National Reparations Declaration. For those who are on the line, if what we've done with this, it is the National Reparations Declaration is not really a book. It is a declaration. It's only 54 pages.
Right.
But at the end of the day, we spell out what reparations really is, who owe us, why they owe us, and why reparations is essential. And I've actually been in publishing books now for over 20 years. And you mentioned one of the greats in the business, one of our own, Paul Coates at Black Classic Press.
Right.
And you know his son, Ta-Nehisi Coates, right, one of the great writers now. You see his books everywhere. But his dad is the founder of Black Classic Press, and they're still doing great work. And then you got Third World Press that's still doing great work. So at the end of the day, I've been doing it for 20 years now, and I learned from Dr. Rosie Milligan out of Los Angeles, Milligan Books, one of the larger black publishing houses also. And so there are black publishing houses that are still there. It's nothing perplexing about publishing. It's detail. And if we're willing to do detail work, we can turn out quality work.
Right.
I guess a couple of books that some of you on the line may have a few years back, I republished along with the Walter Rodney Foundation. We republished the book Grounding with My Brothers. Mm. That was a book that came through here in Atlanta.
I didn't know that. I didn't know you had done that. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, well, you know, it was out back in the 80s, but it was republished back about 5 or 6 years ago, and by the Walter Rodney Foundation, because this foundation is here. His widow is here, Dr. Patricia Rodney, and so she asked us to come in and redo the book for us. So we did redid the cover design, new introduction, and new afterword in the book and everything else. But that was done by us here in Atlanta at the University Publishing Group. Then, too, like I said, we have the declaration out now. And the very first book that I did was called In Fear of Leading. In Fear of Leading.
Mm.
And this is where I took to task those scholars who said nothing happened after the Million Man March. And but anyway, I was going to say, but there are some reputable black publishing companies out there still, and we're doing ebooks too. The ebook is not a quarter of the market yet, depending on what aspect of the market you're talking about. But people are still buying bounded books,
right?
And I even encourage my students to buy bounded books, because at the end of the day, not talking conspiracy theory, but if you got everything ebook and you can't power up, then you can't read.
Right.
And we don't know what will happen in this country. You know, I have some of my students say, well, Professor Muhammad, the only thing I buy is downloaded books. And so now if there's ever a power surge or a power or outage, deliberate or otherwise, how are you going to read? And I guarantee you, the white ruling class and those who are making decisions about the world, they're reading books, and they're still buying bounded books. So that's why Amazon is doing as well as it's doing. But Barnes and Noble, they carry a minimum of 150,000 books on the floor, bounded books. And so I encourage any of you all that are writing, and Dr. Rogers, I know you got one coming out, but I would say encourage you to do your homework. And one of the things that I do and offer, if you ever want to, I do a piece, and I used to do it here in Atlanta. I did it for a few years straight. It's called How to Publish, Promote, and Profit from Your Own Book. How to Publish, Promote, and Profit from Your Own Book. And again, nothing perplexing about it, but I can take you through the 16-step process in about 2.5 hours, and you're ready, without wasting money and time, turn out a very quality product.
Oh, that's something we really need to
read. Did I kind of answer your question, Doc?
Yes, you did. No, that was excellent. Yes, you did. Real quickly, any thoughts of yours about the Black Nationalist classical concept and idea, something that was done, back before by our brother Wilson Moses? Any thoughts? I know you teach political science over there at Clark Atlanta.
Yes, sir.
And you were over there. And as a matter of fact, you know, I thought about the other day, I said, you know, Brother Reggie is sitting over there in that think tank that Du Bois had. Is that still there? Is there any replica of the work that he did there at Clark Atlanta still there? Because I know the
member. Well, that's one of the tragedies, Dr. Rogers, and to your audience, that's one of the tragedies about Clark Atlanta and our HBCUs a lot of the intellectual property that Du Bois did with the Cylon and other publications,
right.
He does not own that. Clark Atlanta allowed, we're talking about hundreds of Du Bois' pieces of work, the copyright to lapse on it, and they don't own the copyright to a lot of the Du Bois' work, even work that he did at the AU Center.
Right.
And that's one of the tragedies. And my thing is, you'll hear me use the term that we were blessed to coin called social symbolic. Well, I think to a degree, blacks have, the black educators and the black bourgeois sector, brother, we have become social symbolic. We have been steeped in a model that's social symbolic. And what do I mean by that? These fools lose the copyright to Du Bois' work, and the only thing it requires you to do is to make sure that when the copyright comes up, you renew the copyright. And sometimes that's $30 and $40, you know, per book or whatever the article is.
Right.
And the university didn't do that on a lot of Du Bois' work. So Boston University owns a lot of the, where they got the Du Bois Center, they own a number of pieces of his intellectual property.
Mm-hmm.
And things that he did at the AU Center. And again, because we did not follow the copyright, we did not renew the copyright.
Right.
And
right.
What's significant about the copyright is that that's one of the first things you want to do with your, with those on the line, because I know many of you all are writing, and at some point will publish, is that, you know, you get your copyright, and it's what they call, you go online to the U.S. Copyright Office, and it's what they call the TX form, and you pay the $45, and but the copyright lasts a lifetime plus 75 years.
Okay.
A lifetime plus 75 years. And you, what you're copywriting is not a title of the book, but any original expression or research that you've done, that's what you have, you're able to copyright and have that as your intellectual property.
Exactly.
Does that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense. Thank you so much.
And that's
important.
So, yeah, I urge any of you all, if you're sending your work out to publishers, or if you're going to do it yourself, one of the first things you do is, if you got a finished manuscript, you go ahead and copyright that manuscript. So if it ever get out in the public domain and you find somebody has used your work, you can always sue them.
Yeah.
And I guess one of the biggest copyright infringements that you saw, there was a book I'll call her name in a minute. But it was the biggest, largest copyright suit maybe 10 years ago. She wrote the book called The Third Eye. And lo and behold, she had sent the book The Third Eye to a number of New York publishing houses.
Uh-huh.
And nobody responded back to her. A couple of the smaller publishing responded back to her. And they weren't giving her what she wanted for her original work. And so she kind of forgot about it, and lo and behold, she's sitting up in the theater
one day.
And she sees her work on the major screen.
Yeah.
And the Matrix.
Yeah, the Matrix. That's right.
All of that
mm-hmm.
Was stolen from a black woman, and so because Octavia
she had Butler.
No, it wasn't Octavia Butler. She did a lot of science fiction work.
It wasn't Octavia Butler.
I'll call her name in a minute. But anyway, it was stolen by some Europeans. But the book was called The Third Eye. But that was the largest copyright infringement. I said that to say that because she had copywritten her work, they still have not settled the suit because they've offered her peanuts compared to because The Matrix and several other movies were made from that original
book.
That's
right. The Wachowski brothers were the ones that stole it. The Wachowski brothers is what they were.
Yeah, exactly. It was some brothers that stole the work.
Mm-hmm.
But they made a couple other movies besides The Matrix offer. And so there has been a back and forth about how it was going to be settled. And her thing is that it's worth billions of dollars, not just a few million dollars that they want to offer her for it.
Exactly.
So, but anyway, I said that to say, make sure you copyright your work because it's an intellectual property, and even if we're not around 50 or 60 years from now, your family and your heirs will enjoy the benefit of it. And again, because it's an original expression, and the copyright lasts a lifetime plus 75 years.
That's beautiful.
If you and I are not around by 2050, Well, after 2050, if you copyright it, you add another 75 years before you have to renew that copyright again.
Right, right. That's interesting. Well, I appreciate that so much. And, you know, and I think just the mere fact that what you're talking about, when you're talking about black nationalism, one of the things that I thought about is with the great mind of the great W.B. Du Bois, he still was not accepted in that academic community the way he should have been. He was rejected from a lot of things by the so-called Ivy League scholars.
Yes, sir.
And he was blackballed in being able to present and do some things. They questioned his scholarship in several many ways, just like they did John Henry Clark. You know, they John Henry Clark called hell. Even though as brilliant as his mind was and as deep as his scholarship was, he still was not openly embraced like you would think he wanted to have. So, yeah, that's great. Thank you so much, Brother Reginald. Tell us how you can get a copy of your publication real quickly.
Well, please, if you would go to our website, NationalReparationsInstitute.org, NationalReparationsInstitute.org. You can order the book there, or you can download the ebook there. Or I'm going to give you all my number if you want to. If you don't want to do all of that, if you want to I'm going to give you Cash App me for the book. The book is only $11.95. And then if you're not in the Atlanta area, I've got to ship it out to you. So just add another $4 to it and make it $15.95. Round it off $16, and I will mail it out to you immediately. In a padded envelope, but I want you to read it, give me your critique and your criticism. And what's key about it is that this is not a book of history of atrocities. Well, what we've done with it, we've actually quantified it, Doc, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but we've quantified and show you how much they owe us, and based on stolen labor, the land that was taken from us, the wealth gap, and then years of neglect and the murder of black people. So we were able to quantify it. That's what's a little different about the Declaration, and spell out what reparations look like. As you know, as nationalists, we're constantly talking about land, because we know land is the basis of freedom and of having some land and territory and some states that we can control our own. Well, we give you in that, we look at 12 states that would be key for black
people. What's your phone number?
Operate independently of.
Right.
What's your phone number, Brother Reggie?
Yeah, my phone number is 404-645-0513. Let me give it to you again. 404-645-0513. And if you want to just cash at me and then text me your address, I'll make sure in the next day or two we're doing another bulk mailer and we sent it out first class, so it should get to you within 5 to 7 days, and we'll send that that declaration on out. And I want you scholars and brothers who are just activists and workers in the movement to give me a critique, because we have the National Reparations Summit coming up in July and August, and those who people from all over the country will be involved in it, and some of you all will be involved in it. So, but I want you to have read the Declaration.
Professor Doc, Muhammad,
can I say something about Du Bois piece too? Does somebody else have any other questions?
Yeah, I think another brother was asking. Yeah, go right ahead, my brother.
Professor Muhammad.
Yes, sir.
Towards the conversation in reparations, I've been writing a bit myself, and I think that a major component, in addition to our seeking monetary remuneration for the unpaid labor of our ancestors in the Western Hemisphere and the compounded situations that came from that, I think that the conversation need be expanded to talking to the AU, the African Union, for reparations as land concessions for the historical kidnapping and displacement of our ancestors.
Well, brother, that's a good point. And honestly, I'm working on a paper that I got. I'm actually in the PhD program, and I'm working on a paper dealing with the AU and reparations. Here's the problem, though. The African Union, brother, after its early inception from the OAU, OAU, they had a position on reparations. The AU has not established a position on reparations. And because part of what you have now is a takeover by these wannabe neoliberals in the AU. And brother, they have taken they keep buying into loans and structural adjustments from the World Bank and other multinational corporations and other governments. And brother, they have taken an anti-Pan-African. We know the great work of Nkrumah and others, but they have taken an anti-Pan-African position. And again, so you raised the question about Du Bois. Well, the reason Du Bois is not embraced is the same reason that the African Union is not embracing Du Bois or Nkrumah today, is because you got to. This is a segment of the petty bourgeois suite, the petty bourgeois sector, brothers and sisters on the line, and they are afraid of a Pan-African black nationalist position.
Yes, they are.
And so
yes, they are.
Many of them have gone in, they're in bed with the corporations. So, brother, they neglect the masses of their people just to have favor with Western and European governments. And the European government, they, if you go to their website and look at any of the works that they've done over the last 20 years, they don't say anything. They have not taken an official position on reparations. But they're brothers and sisters.
If I may, I think that, and thank you all for being so gracious and so indulgent. This will be my last intervention, hopefully. I think that in the least, no one's rendered a strategic plan or a grand design for that. And in the past 20 years, in this very century, the UN has created five nations of different states, South yep. Sudan, Bhutan, Montenegro. And the UN, as a body composed mostly of people of color, is more into creating states for other people of color than American whites or European whites have ever been into paying reparations. And so I think that a conversation around a black nationalist conversation, like once we figure out what exactly a black nation is, it need be had with the UN in conjunction with the AU, and we judge our Pan-Africanist sincerity on whether they're down to pay up for the historical sins of their ancestors, like we're calling for these white people to do on this side of the ocean.
Right.
I think in the least, the conversation as to what that would look like, what would a reparative state for Amer Africans look like, is a step better than the conversation about can we all get together. In addition to, and I think that that component, in addition to your integral work. And actually doing the math of what it would take on this side. But really, there's no bigger business than statecraft, bro.
I'm with you on that. Because when I say reparations, brother, reparations in America and on the continent or in the Caribbean, brother, we're talking complete reparations. And that means a separate state and territory. I'm not talking political patchwork or economic patchwork here, brother. We're talking about the ultimate package is the separate state and territory. And I agree with you, but what I'm still saying to you too, brother, one of the things that I found that is missing in the reparations movement, whether on the continent or in America, is where is your model, your methodology for doing what you say you want to do? And that's the blueprint of how you get from point A to point B. And what I'm saying about the AU, brother, you're right. Africa will never see the masses of our people on the continent, all 55 countries that come under the African Union banner or the auspices of the African Union, all 55 of the countries there, until we have a comprehensive reparations program, our people never will see the level of freedom, justice, and equality and the sustainability that they're looking for and the restoration and the transformation
of our, the masses of our people without reparations. Same thing with Haiti. And until Haiti has a complete reparations program, it's all political patchwork in the end if we don't. So I'm with you on reparations. The point is that how do you get the bourgeois sector of the African Union to know that if you really are about the business of your people and liberating your people, then it has to be reparations. And regardless of and the problem with the UN, though, brother, is that it's so dominated. You got African leaders in the UN, but they're not running the UN to that degree. Right. And as long as they cooperate with America and other European powers, they're allowed to have seats and they're allowed to have a voice to a degree. But when you start talking reparations with European people, brother, they're your friends until you start talking complete reparations, not political patchwork and economic patchwork, but reparations in its completed, finished form. This is when you lose Europeans who have been your allies.
Well, brother Reginald, I really appreciate it. I got a couple more folks. Got about 15 minutes.
Excuse me,
I appreciate you, though, man. I appreciate you coming on and giving us that
number. I'll reach out, brother Reggie.
And that feedback, yeah.
No, yes, sir. Excuse me, Doc. Go ahead.
So, yeah, I was just saying, I really appreciate you coming on and giving us that feedback because this is important. This is a part of Black nationalism. This is exactly what's rooted in that learning process of this system. So, yeah, thank you so much, and thank you, my brother,
Thank you, brother.
The question. Okay, listen, take care of yourself. I appreciate you. I don't know if you can stay on with us to the end, but if so.
Yeah, I'm going to stay on and listen, Doc.
Oh, good. Perfect. Let me go to Brother Lush real quick. Brother Lush, how you doing tonight?
Good evening, everyone. Good evening. I'm just listening on this evening and take a whole lot of notes. Thank you.
Brother Lush, you caught it. We lost you. Brother Lush?
Hello, can you hear me now?
Okay, now I can hear you. Uh-huh.
Okay, yeah, I'm just listening tonight and taking a whole lot of notes. So I got pen and paper and just writing my notes as I go. So
I
thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. Brother Timothy, Philadelphia. How you doing, Brother Timothy?
Brother, it's a good conversation, brother. And I sold you with a brother by the name of Brother Eric 2X. And I had the lessons, 120 degrees, the message to the black man, our savior has arrived for America, and he had the newspapers. He had trunks full of, I got to catch him as a matter of fact, he had trunks full of newspapers.
Uh-huh.
One of our favorite paper was when you had the brother from the eastern part of the world, the other brother from the western part, grabbing each other's arm, and the snake, the cartoons that the messenger had when it came to the print. Now, one of the worst things that Wallace D. Muhammad did, always have in your mind, that he sold the printing press. Not just the land and the jets. He sold the power of the press. People don't realize how important that is. Now, I'm saying that to you that I don't know if Haki Atabuli still has Third World Press.
Yes, sir, he does.
Know. Okay, that's good. He needs to keep it around. And I also will say to you that you have to talk to Brother Marvin X. He probably know better than me. That before Mary Baraka died, with all his work that he did, somehow he gave a lot of his work to Howard. He was a Howard man, and Raz Baraka graduated from Howard. So in other words, he said, look, if I'm leaving here, I'm doing this to my people, my university. Now, how far that went, I don't know. But what you're saying about the power of the print is important. And I like this conversation.
Right. Very important.
Yeah, when I say that, it's because some people don't want to publish your book. Some people don't like what you, let me give you another example. You have black papers in Philadelphia, but they got to go to white newspapers. So I used to write out an op-ed page in Philadelphia Tribune. And I used to look at my work and I said, there's a misspelled words here. A friend of mine pulled me aside, guess what? He said, guess what? You may give it to the Tribune, but they don't have their own printing press. And they don't care what comes through that press. So they might not like what Dr. Rogers wrote and Dr. Bridges and everybody else. They don't care. But somebody who they care about, go make sure the print is out. It's a very important concept. A very important thing about the power of the press. Marcus Garvey, Elijah Muhammad, William Lloyd, Barrett Garrison. Oh, my God. People just don't know. Good conversation.
Right. That's it. Beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Thank you so much.
You got it.
Brother Reggie, I think Dr. Bridges said you were on. Brother Reggie, how you doing tonight? Newport, North Carolina. Brother Reggie?
What's up, brother?
Oh, good. Fine. How you doing?
I'm doing fine, brother. Good to hear you guys.
Good. Thank you.
I'm just enjoying the conversation. You guys keep on going.
All right. I appreciate you. I'm looking forward to working with you on that project we talked about now. Okay?
Hey, I'm waiting. I'm waiting. No doubt about it. I'm being patient.
Okay. Sounds good. All right.
All right.
Sister Didi, I don't know whether you knew. I know one of your heroes is John Henry Clark. And I appreciate you, mine too. But I don't know if you knew that, you know, academically he was rejected in a lot of ways by certain members of the community because he had not gotten his PhD. And as brilliant as he was and the scholarship that he offered in terms of his research, I mean, he was, the research surpassed any Ivy League scholar. But he still caught a lot of slack. And a lot of it came from our own people. Did you know that, Sister Didi? Sister Didi, did you know that? Okay, I thought she was on. I see her number. Maybe she's not on the line. Okay, sounds good. All right, let's go to 414-1295. My sister, you want to say something?
Oh, good evening, Doc. Dr. Rogers. Good evening. I'm enjoying the conversation as well, learning a lot.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Sister Benisawa, how you doing tonight? Feeling better? Sister Benisawa, are you feeling a little better tonight?
Hello?
Yes, how are you?
Oh, my goodness. How are you, Doc? I thought I had my phone on mute.
Oh, yeah.
Background noise over here.
How you doing? You feeling better tonight?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, I am. You sound fresh.
Yes,
good.
Thanks for asking.
Yeah. Any thoughts?
So, greetings, everybody. Did you say something, Doc?
No, I just said, any thoughts you have about this discussion?
Of course.
Okay. All right. Say, of course.
Hey, Bruce, Dr. Bridges, you know, Dr. Rogers, you know I'm going to have something to say.
Okay.
The way that you started off, Dr. Rogers, teaching about Thomas Jefferson.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And his, the fact that he was a pedophile, he was a rapist, he was a racist, evil dog.
Mm-hmm.
And I sit and I listen to the black intellectuals that they allow on the media, CNN, MSNBC, et cetera. I listen to them talk about him as, you know, Thomas Jefferson and others, you know, of his ilk, let's say, as their brothers, and make references to their, you know, the things that they said that were supposed to be so great in reference to their, you know, being the founding fathers and assisting in building this country.
Right.
And I look at who we, you know, give reverence to, and these people are just straight up savages. And I've said this many times, I have a real problem with that. And that's because we don't know our history. I think we wouldn't tolerate that from the Cornel Wests and the Michael Eric Dysons, et cetera, if we knew our history. And when I say we, I'm talking about grassroots people because, you know, the majority of us have not gone to HBCUs and taken, you know, Africana studies courses and whatnot. And most of us don't know who Dr. John Henry Clark was. You know, and some of our other great historians. Bruce, you still on the line?
Yeah, he's still on.
Just listening to you.
Do you remember the first time I met you? I had no idea that you were a historian.
In Greensboro, I think, yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, at my house. I had no idea that you were a historian. I would have been picking your brain. So for a few years, I did not know. So my whole point is that the masses are idolizing and pedestalizing people who are their oppressors.
Right. And I would like to see. You're saying that's the best they know.
That's the whole point. We
masses
don't know. And as we're talking about, you know, Jay Rogers and all these various great historians, Renoka Rashidi, we brought him to Greensboro. He taught us stuff that people just blew people's minds because the masses don't know. And I want to see the masses. I want us to find ways through our black media, what we do have, to get this information to the masses. Because, Doc, that Zoom call that we were on last night,
yes, indeed.
I guarantee you that maybe one of those people knew anything about black history, African history.
Yeah.
And they're revolutionaries and they want to make a change, but, you know, we are crazy. We're beautiful, we're creative, but we're also crazy because we have lost our African minds. And knowing what happened to us historically, I always want to go back to that. We understand what happened to us historically, that there's nothing wrong with us. Something was done to us. We were created Frankenstein beings. Then we could really move forward in our revolutionary works. I truly believe that. So let's get this information to the masses. Let's do everything we can. Because I'm still a student. I'm still an early student.
I'm a student, too.
And I agree with you 100%, Sister Benice, why it really does need to get to the masses. But it's... Even with all this technology, it still seems like it's just such a difficult task. But anyway, we don't have that much time to talk about that tonight. But anyway, it's a difficult task, even with all the major forms of communication that we have to get to the masses. But the masses just don't get it. They don't get this. And that's also by design. That's another topic. Capitalism, as Stokely Carmichael used to tell us, capitalism always wants to keep the people ignorant. That's it.
That's right. Right.
Well, we can fight that, and that's all I'm going to say. We can fight that. Yeah, we can find a way to get this information to the masses.
Let me ask Brother Reggie and you, Brother Bridges, a question. If you had asked your student to bring to turn in a paper, and they referenced Wikipedia, what would you do?
Oh no, I don't. No, they better come up with another reference for it. Even if it came from Wikipedia, they better get it. You know, put somebody else's name beside it who I might not know and might not be able to trace it back. But no, I don't. I don't like that. No, not at all.
What about you, Brother Rich? What will you do?
Is that for me, Dr. Rogers?
Yeah, I'm asking if you had one of your students.
Yeah.
Turn you
well,
in a paper.
What I normally do, brother, I would give assignments where I know that they can't go online and possibly find some of this information.
Yes.
They've got to go to the library and pull a copy because one of the things that we're seeing, brother, our students are missing out on volumes of work because remember we just started digitizing probably 15 to 17 years ago.
Right.
We're looking at all the great bodies of work, especially among black writers and the works of Dr. John Henry Clark and Asa Hiller and Francis Cress Wilson. A lot of that has not been digitized yet. So what I do in my politics and global issues class, I make sure that at the end of the day, you got to go pull a hard copy for your research. Because a lot of the books I will have personally, so I know that they have not been digitized. And a lot of times, and when they do it, I let them know off the bat, I need a number of citations, and don't go online to get those citations because I'm going to check your work. If not, you know, you fail the test. Particular subject or that particular course or that assignment, if the fact that you can't bring me citations that we can reference, not necessarily that you go online Wikipedia, and because sometimes the Wikipedia information is current, sometimes it's not, you know.
Right, exactly. You're right.
But about that. No, I flunk students for doing that, and our students have gotten lazy where they think if they can't find it online, it does not exist. Mm-hmm. That's one of the struggles in the academy, though.
Right, exactly right, brother. What about you, Sister Edwards? Would you, if one of your students turned you in a Wikipedia paper, would you accept it? Sister Marquita Edwards?
Yes, sir.
Would you accept it?
I'm sorry, sir, I didn't hear the question.
Oh, I asked this, if a student turned in a Wikipedia paper that they had gotten the information on Wikipedia, would you accept that?
If I had gotten some information from Wikipedia,
no, if you had gotten a student turn in assignment, and they
I wouldn't. No, I did have to do some deeper research.
Okay, right. Brother Timothy.
Yeah, they have more research than Wikipedia.
Right. Great. I'm glad. Brother Timothy, what is your... Well, he just went
on. I just want to say a few things, sir, that I was told that, and the brother that's at Clark, Atlanta right now, that when it came to Martin Luther King's writing in his paper, is it at University of Boston or is that Clark, Atlanta? If it was at Clark, Atlanta, I had to say this about the King family. The King family has a lot to do with selling a lot of his stuff.
Yeah.
So I hope they don't get into selling his stuff. And if it's at Clark, Atlanta that he did, I hope they keep it there. And I don't know what's going on. It's a conversation. You don't turn, and some stuff you just don't sell.
Right.
I think they sold the house.
Well, Brother Timothy, I'm sorry to cut you off. It's 9 o'clock. We do off the air. Dr. Bridges, when the closing remarks, real quick, it is 9 o'clock already. They will cut us off the air if we don't move. So any quick closing remarks?
I have nothing to say. What I said, that was what I had. Maybe next week we could talk about that more.
Okay. Dr. Bridges, any closing remarks? Okay, very good. Okay, thank you, folks. Have a good week. I will see you next week, and we'll be right here on Tuesday. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Black Reality Think Tank. Get up,
stand up. Thank you, Dr. Rogers. Stand up, thank you. Right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Don't give up the fight. Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is on the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth. It's a call that Peter is cold after story had never been told. So now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your right. Come on, get up.
Sick and tired of your isms, kisses.